Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. The court is now ready to hear argument in the case of United States against Miller. Mr. Stevens.
May it please the court, I'm actually Matt Soliday. Mr. Stevens and I had a mix-up on the names, so I represent Rick Fines. There were two evidentiary rulings in this case that were very important. If the judge had ruled differently, we believe the case would have come out differently. The time frame in this case was critical. The first one I'd like to talk about is the picture of my client, Mr. Fines, which is in the appendix, of him sitting underneath a gun rack in a chair. And we believe this picture should not have been admitted. It was being offered through the testimony of Leroy Miller, Ike Miller. And when the prosecutor first asked Ike, do you know when these were taken, he said no. Then there was a leading question of, well, were they taken in 2003 or 2004? He answers yes. And then there are a few more questions, and then it's actually offered into evidence.
There was no objection to that leading question, was there?
There was not an objection. It came, not at that exact moment, no, Your Honor, there was not. There was. I had started objecting before they even got to the time frame of when the picture was taken. Then there was the time frame question, and then after the offer, I objected on the foundation because of the time frame once it was offered by the prosecutor.
What do you think the critical time was when he discovered that Mr. Fines was a felon?
Well, I think the critical time was the timing in the indictment of the 2003 to 2004, I think, was the critical time. Mr. Miller and Mr. Fines had been friends since, I think, 1999. Had been a long time. And then when Mr. Miller was sick, he actually moved into the home of Mr. Miller. And the time frame was also different because in the picture, it's just a chair. It's not a recliner. My client had a number of medical issues and was actually sleeping in a recliner, and that chair was not a recliner, so it couldn't have been the same chair that was in there during the 2003-2004 timing. The prosecution also says that there was another witness by the name of Glenn Hisong who gave a time frame, but he was also led with the 2003-2004 question by the prosecutor. On cross-examination, he didn't know the year when they were actually taken. The other evidentiary issue that I'd like to talk about is the folder of receipts. There was a folder of receipts that had different gun parts and those sort of things that had my client's information on them that were found in the room where he actually slept in the recliner. And we objected on a number of grounds, and the government cited the Soriano case, which I think was different from this case, because in that case it was a drug case, and they were trying to connect the defendant to the actual premises. And in this case, there really was no dispute as to whether my client lived in that house or, you know, slept in that room at all. If they were utility bills, you know, we wouldn't have had a problem with it. But since they were actual gun parts, we did feel that they were hearsay, that there was a lack of foundation, and that they should not have been admitted. And with that, unless Your Honors have any question, I'd like to pass to Mr. Stevens for the remainder.
Certainly. Mr. Stevens.
I'm Jay Stevens, representing Mr. Miller. Mr. Miller raises 2 points on appeal. The first issue is sufficiency of the evidence, and the second issue is whether the court erred in its guideline determination pursuant to U.S. Sentencing Guideline 2K2.1B2. Regarding the sufficiency of the evidence, has already been alluded to, one of the time frames that's important in this case is the date when Mr. Miller learned that Mr. Fines was a convicted felon, because he wasn't charged with possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. What he was charged with is aiding and abetting Mr. Fines's possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. Now, Mr. Fines lived in Mr. Miller's house. He had his own private room in the house. Guns that were referred to in the course of the trial were in Mr. Fines' room. And there's no question that Mr. Fines, as a convicted felon, was in possession of a firearm which had traveled in interstate commerce. The issue that we bring to this court is whether Leroy Miller aided and abetted Mr. Fines in the possession of those firearms. Now, I say the dates are important because a review of the evidence in the case shows that the government at no time pointed to any time after Mr. Miller learned that Mr. Fines was a convicted felon, that he bought guns for Mr. Fines, that he sold guns for Mr. Fines, he in any way assisted Mr. Fines. The government's testimony by Ike Miller said the guns in Mr. Fines' room belonged to Mr. Fines. The government's testimony through Ike Miller, found at pages 18 and 19 of Volume 2, said that Mr. Miller used Mr. Fines' workbench to work on his own guns. Mr. Miller had his own collection, but Mr. Fines owned the guns that were in his room. That's not aiding and abetting. The government is left with a theory that simply says renting a room to a person who has, to a convicted felon who has firearms in the room, is aiding and abetting that person's possession. And because
I thought, counsel, the prosecutor's position was that the defendants cooperated with respect to the ownership, sometimes trading, of these weapons.
Well, there certainly was some testimony, Judge Easterbrook, about some buying and selling of firearms, but we don't know when, and that's the problem with the government's case. Because there was a period of time from when Mr. Fines moved in until he learned that Mr. Miller learned that Mr. Fines was a convicted felon, that any transactions would not have been aiding and abetting because he didn't know that Mr. Fines was a convicted felon. And the government didn't pin down any time frame whatsoever in the buying and selling of these guns. Now, the government has attached a receipt to their brief, and that, or a summary of one of the exhibits that was in the case, and that refers to approximately, I believe it was 28 firearms that were purchased by Mr. Miller. Only 17 of those firearms were seized in the raid. We don't know when those firearms that were not on that list were sold. They certainly could have been sold, most of them, before the transaction before the time that Mr. Miller learned of the conviction.
Was there evidence of who moved the weapons from the house to the shed?
Ike Miller testified that he moved approximately a dozen of those firearms.
And wasn't that done at the direction of his father?
We don't know whether those firearms were ones that had been purchased by Mr. Miller or not.
Wasn't the moving out of Fine's room of those firearms done at the direction of Mr. Miller's
father? It was done, according to Ike Miller, at the direction of his father.
And this was after the ATF agent visited the home, but before the search.
But the important thing is that Agent Emmons said that he never identified himself as an ATF agent when he went to the house, and that's found at page 30 of Volume 1 of the transcript. So Mr. Miller had no reason to believe that Agent Emmons was an ATF agent. So the moving of the firearms doesn't raise a presumption that he knew that a search warrant was on the way.
Well, the issue is, though, was he aiding Mr. Fines in his possession of those weapons?
And I would submit that no, he's not. What he's doing, quite arguably, is removing those firearms from Mr. Fines' possession. And that's not a crime. It's only a crime if he intends to assist Mr. Fines in concealing them, and there's no evidence he had any reason to believe there was any reason to conceal them. For those reasons, I would ask the court to remand this case with direction to enter a judgment of acquittal. With regard to my second point, the issue of the interpretation of 2K2.1b2, just very briefly, the government's witnesses, Hisong said they were buying and selling for a firearm collection. Ike Miller said the guns were for collecting and occasionally sold. Willie Longston at sentencing said he considered the guns collectibles. There was considerable evidence at the time of sentencing that these firearms were collectibles for collecting purposes. Judge Miller felt that the mere fact that you sell a gun takes it out of possession, or it takes it out of possession for collecting purposes, and that therefore the reduction under 2K2.1B2 does not apply. We contend that that is in disagreement with the Collins, Shell, and Palermi cases as cited in the reply brief. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Stevens and Mr. Soliday, my name is John Machasek, and I represent the government in this case. Do any members of the court have an issue that they would prefer me to address first? If not, I'll start by addressing the issue of the sufficiency of the evidence with regard to the conviction of Mr. Fines and Miller, since both defendants raised that issue in this case. And I will also start by conceding that there, with regard to Mr. Miller, there is no evidence that Mr. Miller directly handed Mr. Fines a firearm. This was a circumstantial evidence case. But there is a great deal, a very large amount of circumstantial evidence in this case. The evidence was that Mr. Fines lived with Mr. Miller for a period of about 2.5 years. A year and a half of that time, he was after Mr. Miller became aware that Mr. Fines was a convicted felon. And during that time period, the evidence, based on the testimony and the photograph that is Exhibits 11 and 12, or 12 and 13, shows that Mr. Miller allowed Mr. Fines to live in a room that was full of firearms, approximately 40, according to the testimony of Ike Miller. And the evidence shows that there was also a workbench in that room where work on firearms was conducted by Mr. Fines during the time period alleged in the indictment, and that was the testimony of Ike Miller. And books that pertain to firearm repair, gunsmithing, firearms assembly and disassembly, and things like that. Furthermore, there's evidence of a guilty conscience on the part of Mr. Miller and Mr. Fines. The court noted that the evidence was that the firearms were removed from Mr. Fines' room sometime between the visit of Agent Emmons and when the search warrant was conducted. Now, the mere fact that Mr. Emmons didn't identify himself as an ATF agent, I don't think takes this, removes the possibility of the jury implying from this evidence that the defendants were trying to avoid the possibility of the guns being found in Mr. Fines' room. And as the district court concluded during the sentencing phase, there was a great deal of evidence that the guns were actually moved during that time period. There's also evidence that Fines and Miller both lied about where the guns had been during the time period of the indictment. Mr. Miller told Agent Emmons during his interview with Mr. Emmons that he had moved the guns out of the home prior to Mr. Fines moving in because he was concerned about his psychological welfare. And Mr. Fines told another agent that when he had moved into the house, the guns had already been moved out. And the evidence clearly showed that wasn't the case at all. There's also evidence of the idea that two collectors would store, or that a collector, if that's what Mr. Miller was, would store guns in a outbuilding for over 2.5 years at his house is actually absurd, and I'm sure that the jury concluded that that was not the case. Furthermore, when Agent Emmons examined the guns, they were all wiped. They were completely clean. There was no rust on them, no fingerprints on them, not even smudges or partial fingerprints, which is unusual and indicates that the guns had been recently wiped down. And finally, and there are a number of other matters that I could, or smaller items of information with regard to the sufficiency of the evidence, but that's the bulk of the evidence, and the evidence clearly is something that is when considered in the light most favorable to the government, is adequate for a jury to have found that Mr. Miller had aided Mr. Fiennes in the possession of the guns during the relevant time period.
Where was the ammunition kept? The ammunition, where was it kept?
The Mr. Miller testified that there were thousands of rounds of ammunition found at the house. Mr. Miller testified that most of the ammunition was also kept in Mr. Fiennes' room and was also moved out to that outbuilding. I believe he said at the same time the other guns were moved out.
The ammunition was moved to the shed.
Was moved to the shed, yes. With regard to the, I'll talk about the admission of Exhibit 11. Exhibit 11 was originally offered approximately 80 pages of receipts that were found on the workbench in Mr. Fiennes' room in a folder. And the receipts were receipts that were for gun purchases and also gun part purchases, and some other manuals pertaining to firearms operation and disassembly and that sort of stuff. Under Serrano and Thornton, that exhibit was originally offered to simply show the connection between Mr. Fiennes and Mr. Miller and the guns themselves and their cooperative, enterprise with which regard to them. And the government's theory of the case was that they had been cooperating in refurbishing guns and reselling them, a quasi-business, as Judge Miller called it. Under Thornton and Serrano, the documents were admissible for that purpose. They were also self-authenticating documents under Rule 901b-4 because of the distinctive characteristics of the documents that were contained in that folder, and that was specifically relied or mentioned by the court in U.S. versus Thornton, which Judge Kaney, you were on the panel for that. With regard to the photograph, the standard, as with the Exhibit 11, is abuse of discretion. And here, all that's necessary for a photograph to be admitted is for somebody with knowledge to be able to testify that the photograph accurately depicts something at issue. And in this case, that's exactly what we had. Mr. Miller couldn't say exactly the date when he took the photograph, but I asked him if the photograph depicted the room in a time frame that was covered by the indictment, and he said yes. So we not only had somebody who was quite familiar with what was depicted in the photograph, but also the actual photographer.
Didn't Hisong give some testimony about that as well?
Mr. Hisong did say originally the photograph depicted the room as it appeared during 2003, late 2003 to early 2004. But I think on cross-examination, he waffled on that a little bit. But his original testimony was that it accurately depicted the room. The final issue, Your Honor, with regard to whether sentencing guideline 2K2.1B2 applies to Mr. Miller. I think this is an issue that turns on the standard of review. And I believe that the cases that were cited by the reply brief, Palmieri and, the Palmieri case, and the statutory...
Why does the standard of review matter? The question at issue, as I understand it, is one about the meaning of the guideline.
Yes, Your Honor.
The meaning of the guideline is something we will determine without deference to the district court's rulings.
Yes, Your Honor, but...
So it can't turn on the standard of review. We're going to make an independent decision.
Well, If the reason I say that, Your Honor, is because the judge said that simply disposing of one firearm takes you out of collection purposes for
that's purpose. Right. The district judge took the position that as soon as anybody sells a firearm, he's not eligible for a reduction under 2K2.1B2. And the question, it's purely one of law, is whether that's right. These defendants, or Miller in particular, because that's what it matters for, may well have been a dealer, or he may well have had a firearm, the one over the door, that's unrelated to collection. That's not the ground on which the district court decided this issue. District court said, as a matter of law, anybody who ever sells any gun can never get that reduction. And I want to know whether you think that makes sense. Normally, we think of collectors as both buying and selling. Coin collectors sell some coins in order to fill holes in their collection with other coins. And even art museums will sell particular art. I sometimes wish museums would sell more Jackson Pollocks than they do in order to collect better art. Why does selling make one not a collector?
Well, it may surprise you, Judge Easterbrook, but I agree that selling one does not make does not take you out of the collector ambit.
And doesn't it follow that we need to remand for resentencing?
No, Your Honor, and that's why I wanted to get to the standard of review with regard to the judge's evidentiary decisions on that issue, because, as you know, you can uphold the district court's decision on bases other than the specific holding of the district court if there are other reasons for doing that. And my position is that there is another reason for upholding the denial of the benefit of that guideline in this case, and that's because, as a factual matter, the judge determined that the defendants in this case were engaged in a business of refurbishing and reselling firearms that was distinct from collection.
The problem is that if you look at the district judge's discussion, Judge Miller wrote a very careful sentencing memorandum at pages 4 to 5. There is no finding there that they ran a business. The only conclusion is that as a matter of law, if you sell one gun, you're outside the 2K2.1B2.
Well,
maybe I'm missing something. What should
well,
I look
if you,
at?
Well, if you would look at the sentencing memorandum at page 14, Your Honor. And specifically, Judge Miller states that Miller bought and sold a significant number of firearms in late 2003 and early 2004 involving Mr. Fines, by then known to be a felon, in the quasi-business and provided him with access to more than 24 firearms. And he also states on page 4 that Mr. Fines and he refinished and refurbished several others for resale. So he did make a finding, Your Honor, that they were engaged in a quasi-business.
You see, that's exactly the problem. That just goes back to the proposition that if you clean something up and resell it, you're not a collector. Now, suppose an art museum sends art restoration experts to a painting. They clean it up. They remove old grime. They put it in a better frame. And they then have it auctioned at Christie's in order to raise money to improve other features of their collection. You've already said that you thought that they're still a collector. So I don't know why the proposition that somebody cleaned something and sold it makes them not a collector.
Well, it's because they told other individuals that they had that business of refurbishing, cleaning up, refurbishing, and reselling these firearms. Now, there was testimony at the sentencing hearing that it wasn't a very good business for them because they really weren't making much money and they weren't very sophisticated at it. But
and they were violating about 16 criminal laws.
Yes. Well,
yeah, well, that makes it a really bad business. We're only worried about the penalty for their really bad business.
And so Judge Miller said this is a tough decision, kind of a muddy line in between collector and business. But he did make a finding that there was a business, and I'm
he said at quite some distance from where he's actually discussing this issue, quasi-business. I have no idea what quasi means, except quasi usually means it's not a business, it's not X, but it's, I'm not sure what it is quite. Why should, what may be loose language at page 14 detract from the precise analysis of this lawful collection issue at pages 4 and 5? I mean, Judge Miller told us in no uncertain terms why he had denied this reduction. It's because he thought selling of any firearm ever takes you outside the guideline.
Because there is an alternative basis for upholding the district court's decision. And there is one other one that I would like to mention, and that is selling and or using weapons for sporting purposes or collection purposes, they must also not be used unlawfully according to that guideline. And by providing the guns to Mr. Fines, as the jury found, that was unlawful use. And my position is that completely takes you out of that guideline.
Why is the focus on Miller's possession of these firearms instead of Fine's possession? Because Miller's possession is perfectly legal.
Because
aiding and abetting that's illegal.
Right. Because Mr. Fines could not qualify for that benefit because his underlying felony was arson.
Right, so why should Miller? Because Miller's possession is absolutely irrelevant to the criminal conduct.
That's a great question, Your Honor, and I happen to agree with you, but probation department disagreed with me on that, and that issue really wasn't raised in the district court.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Mr. Soliday, anything further? All right. Nothing from Mr. Soliday. Mr. Stevens.
The government concedes that there is no evidence that during the relevant time periods Mr. Miller gave any firearms to Mr. Fines. They've argued that to allow Fines to live in a room full of firearms is sufficient to find him guilty of aiding and abetting. Well, simply knowing that someone is committing a crime is not aiding and abetting. You have to do something actively bring that about. The government argues that guilty knowledge exists because Mr. Fines and Mr. Miller said those guns have been out there a long time, and when in fact that wasn't true because Ike Miller said he took them out there a month before. Well, that was in the course of an interrogation by ATF agents who said we're investigating possession of a firearm by a convicted felon, something that Mr. Miller obviously knew that Mr. Fines was a convicted felon, and I don't think we can infer a guilty knowledge simply from his attempting to avoid questions about something that he knew was a violation of a law, that being Mr. Fines in possession of firearms. The issue is allowing Mr. Fines to live in a room full of firearms, work on those firearms, sufficient to meet the statute, and I contend that it's not. With regard to the second issue, the government says that Mr. Fines could not lawfully
concede that Mr. Miller allowed Fines to work on those firearms?
I do not. Ike Miller testified that Mr. Fines worked on Mr. Fines' guns, and his dad, Mr. Miller, worked on his own personal guns.
Yeah, on the same workbench.
On the same workbench. But there's not any testimony that there were cross purposes, because Ike Miller says those were all Fines' guns in Fines' room. And those are the ones that Fines worked on. Fines worked on some firearms for a couple of other individuals, but there's no indication, no testimony that Mr. Miller brought those guns to Mr. Fines. So, no, I do not agree that the evidence shows that Mr. Fines worked at Mr. Miller's request on Mr. Miller's guns.
So you also, I think you indicated, at least as to the firearms, their movement to the shed was not because the agent, unidentified as such, visited, but they also moved the ammunition too, right?
Well, I don't think that a jury can infer from the fact that they were moved that there was an aiding and abetting in the possession because he was taking the possession away from Mr. Fiennes. And I don't think the jury can infer that there was...
Mr. Fiennes couldn't go to the shed at all?
The shed, by testimony, was locked, and Mr. Fiennes did not have a key. Agents found it locked when they got there. Mr. Fiennes, I lost my train of thought there. I'll let that one pass. With regard to the second issue, the government says that giving guns to a convicted felon, which they contend that Mr. Miller did, although we dispute that there's evidence to that effect, is unlawful and therefore can't be a lawful use of a weapon. The shell case cited in my reply brief talked about the use of a gun being lawful but for the disability of the individual, and I think that answers that point. I agree that the possession by Mr. Fiennes is the relevant possession, but the evidence clearly shows that Mr. Fiennes, as well as Mr. Miller, was a collector, and that therefore the 2K2.1B2 provision should apply in the event that this court decides that the case should not be
a loaded shotgun in the hallway.
Well,
that got to do with a collection or sporting purpose?
That has nothing to do with
skeet in the house.
And I would draw an analogy. I would draw an analogy between someone who has illegal drugs in their room and the owner of the house who has a prescription bottle of OxyContin that's prescribed to them. The fact that they lawfully possess one drug doesn't mean that it's included in relevant conduct for purposes of the illegal drugs in the other room. Those guns were possessed legally by Mr. Miller, and while Judge Miller, I think, erroneously found that there was constructive possession, Mr. Miller did nothing to aid and abet Mr. Fiennes' constructive possession of his own guns in his own house, particularly the ones on the second floor or the ones that were kept for shooting vermin and varmints.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. And Mr. Soliday, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment and the assistance you've been to the court as well as to your client. The case is taken under advisement.